1985 from 2008, Lucent Technology versus Gateway. Good morning. Give the other side a few more seconds to get in place and then we'd like to begin. Counsel, good morning. Welcome to the court. Please proceed.
May it please the court, Constantine Trella on behalf of Microsoft Corporation. With the court's permission, I'd like to begin with obviousness because I think the differences between the parties there are very discreet. They're pretty well identified in the briefs and I think can be reviewed pretty quickly. With respect to Claim 19 of the Day patent, Lucent first argues that there are no information fields being filled in the datamation, in the system described in the datamation article.
Mr. Trella, yes. Big problem here, it seems to me, is you've got a jury verdict. Right?
We do have a jury verdict, Your Honor.
Even though obviousness is a question of law, there are underlying fact questions, and the jury presumably resolved them.
Well, the jury resolved them, Your Honor, but the jury resolved them incorrectly. As to the information fields issue, the data that's really quibbling about words, I think. The datamation article talks about cells. Cells that require information, information that is provided by on-screen tools, either lists of entries or an on-screen keyboard or numerical keypad. The article says that the data selected by the user is entered into the system. The only reasonable reading of that is that the data is entered into these cells, which are, you know, information fields. That's the term used in the Day patent is information fields. Datamation just uses different words. Some of the other issues really turn on fundamentally claim construction issues or what we think are Lucent's attempts to change the claim construction. For example, Lucent claims that the datamation system does not include graphical tools, but that's because Lucent changes the claim construction to require something called graphics mode, which is found nowhere in the patent, nowhere in the claim construction. If you apply the claim construction, which is it's a graphical keyboard or number pad that the user can use to compose information by pointing to the displayed keys, it's clear that Datamation has that. You can see that in the picture from the article that's reproduced in the appendix. And also there's a smaller version of it in our brief. Another instance where this claim construction revision comes into play is with the concurrent display requirement. The picture from the Datamation article shows the normal meaning of concurrent display, which is at the same time. You have the one side with the various cells, the other side with the keyboard, the on-screen keyboard displayed. Lucent argues that concurrent display in that sense isn't enough, that you have to have overlaid windows. But the claim construction was quite clear that it's concurrent display means display at the same time as by an overlaid window. The district judge made very clear that that was an example, that side-by-side display qualifies. The patent makes clear that the overlaid windows were shown illustratively as an example of concurrent display. That's in column 3 of the patent, I believe. And that leaves only the question whether the indicating step, which we concede is not expressly disclosed in Datamation, would have been obvious to one of ordinary skill. Lucent's argument there amounts to the proposition that highlighting or use of a blinking cursor or something like that to provide the user with feedback indicating where on the screen he was working would not have been obvious.
Mr. Trella, assume if we don't agree with you on obviousness, talk to us a little bit about damages, the entire market rule here. Was it applied? Or were the damages, seems to me the damages were quite in the middle of the ranges suggested by both sides' experts.
I'm happy to talk about damages, Your Honor. The most fundamental problem with the damages award, before you even get to the whole question of was entire market value applied, does it apply here, is that the damages award bears no relationship to any actual showing of infringement. Section 284 requires damages to compensate for the infringement. And the award here doesn't do that. Dynacor held that where indirect infringement is at issue, both liability and damages have to be tied to the plaintiff's proof concerning the underlying direct infringement. And we only have indirect infringement claims here. These are method claims, and there's no allegation that Microsoft practiced the method. So when a plaintiff identifies individual instances of direct infringement, the liability for that and the damages are limited to those individual instances. Where a plaintiff identifies an entire category of infringers, to use Dynacor's term, then the damages can apply to that entire category. But in both instances, you have to show direct infringement. You have to show either that the accused product necessarily practiced the method, and if it didn't, then you have to show that somebody actually used it that way.
So what do you do? You're going to take surveys of people's home usage? After all, there are instruction manuals suggesting usage.
Well, actually, if you look at the record sites that Lucent provided, you're not going to see the kind of instructions that would teach the use of the composition tool, which was the heart of their case as to Outlook in the trial court. But actually, surveys is a form of evidence that this court, I think, in Acco Brands identified as a possible form of evidence. Customer testimony would be another. And of course, Your Honor, you're only in that world, and that's the world we're in this case, if the use of the product doesn't necessarily infringe. If the product has only one use, if it can only be used to infringe, then you don't necessarily have the problem, at least not to the same degree. But here, where it's undisputed that these products have hundreds of non-infringing uses, you have to have some proof that somebody actually practiced the method.
Well, the calendar doesn't have alternative uses, does it?
The date picker tool does not have alternative uses. That's correct, Your Honor. But there's no reason, certainly no evidence that anybody ever used it. And you need that evidence.
So I could, in picking a date, either type in the date or use the tool offered,
you can
if
type,
I preferred.
You can,
and so the former would be a non-infringing use.
That's correct. You can type in the date. You could type in June 2nd, 2009. You could type in Christmas Day. You could type in Valentine's Day. You could type in next Thursday. You could type in tomorrow. All of those will give you a date without using the calendar tool, the date picker.
And you're saying that the product literature, ads and so forth, instruction manuals and other such documents, don't specify using the date picker tool that allows you to do it other than by typing in from the keyboard.
No, I'm not saying that, Your Honor. What I'm saying is that there may well be instructions on how to use the date picker tool, but that does not lead to the conclusion that somebody did it. You have to conclude that somebody actually did it. And instruction, it's like, I think we use the example in our brief. If you have a map with multiple trails, and one of them goes through somebody's property and would cause you to trespass if you used it, you have to prove that the person actually used that trail. The fact that the instruction to use it was there doesn't prove that it happened. And there's no proof here that it happened. And that's the fundamental problem. And when you get past that, Your Honor, and then to turn to finally answer your question, Judge Lurie, the award numerically may be, I haven't done the math, but it certainly is in the range between Microsoft's figure of $6.5 million and Lucent's figure of, I think, somewhere in the neighborhood of $700 million. But the fact that a number is lower than the number the plaintiff throws out there doesn't mean it's supported by the record. Here, the only conceivable basis for this number is the value of the Microsoft products, the Outlook sales, Money sales, Windows Mobile sales. And even if this is some sort of a split the difference kind of calculation by the jury, still that means they used the entire market value, because that was the one end of the range that if they were splitting the range, that's what they were doing. So either way, you've got the entire market value rule implicated here. The only other basis...
Well, the entire market value rule, the sales base is related to the amount of royalty. So if you're using a smaller base, then a higher royalty may fit. If you have a larger base, a lower royalty.
Well, that's true as a matter of arithmetic, Your Honor, but doctrinally, I don't think that approach, which incidentally is the approach Lucent's damages expert essentially said he was using at trial. You can make one big and one small, or do it the other way and get the same number. But I think the case law is very clear that there's a distinction between the two. While they're certainly related, and again, as a matter of arithmetic, you can get to the same place. Doctrinally, that's not the right approach. you only look at the total product revenues as the base if you satisfy the requirements of the entire market value rule, which is the accused feature or component or whatever it is somehow drove demand for the product. Most of the cases say was the basis for demand. Some cases suggest a substantial factor, but in either event, it clearly had to have a substantial influence on demand.
What do you think is really required? That it be the primary cause of the demand, or more than a trivial cause of the demand, or one of six major causes of the demand? Where do we end up here?
Well, Your Honor, let me answer in two parts. First of all, in this case, I don't think you need to confront that issue because there's no evidence that it was one of six, one of 600. There is simply no evidence linking demand for these products to this feature.
And why was it included?
Well, Your Honor, it was included years ago before there was any awareness of this patent. You know, there are hundreds of features in these software products. They're nice. Maybe somebody will use them. Maybe, you know, most people probably don't. There was no reason to take it out.
Is your answer to the Chief's question that if there are six features, then perhaps the damages should be calculated based on 1/6?
Or no.
You factor in the significance of the one, which may be the basis for the demand for the product. It may have been much more valuable than the other five.
Well, I think it's not a question of counting up how many features there are and taking that fraction. I think you have to look at the particular feature at issue and say, did this, in some sense, create the value of the product?
Wasn't there some testimony, whether it had a basis, another matter, but wasn't there some testimony that the demand for Outlook did come from the claimed date picker, et cetera, features?
No, Your Honor. And what happened here is there was testimony that forms are important to Outlook. Tools are kind of nifty in Outlook. The convenient user interface is important. All of these things, and some of it may be true, but they're not the invention. That's the problem.
The invention is limited to certain specified tools for filling out forms.
That's exactly right.
Nothing to do with email or other uses of Outlook.
Exactly, Your Honor. And that's an important point because Lucent's expert conceded at trial that you can, for example, you can send and receive email and you're not infringing this patent. And there was other uncontested testimony that the most important use, the thing that drives demand for Outlook, is email. That's what people primarily use it for. So you can't just take some feature and decide that it drives demand. And when you look at the feature, you have to focus on the patented feature. And that raises another point, Your Honor, and that is that on appeal, Lucent has fairly dramatically expanded its infringement theory. At trial, the theory was very narrowly limited, and I'm going to focus on Outlook because that's 85% or so of Lucent's damages claim. The testimony and the evidence was focused on the appointment form and using the date picker to fill in the form. Their expert testified very clearly, as Judge Michel noted, if you use some other method to fill in that date, you don't infringe. That's not the patented method. Now on appeal, they're taking the position that, well, as long as there's a composition tool somewhere in there, any use of any pop-up tool with any field will infringe this patent.
On a form or on something else?
Well, interestingly, although there's a lot of talk about form filling, Claim 19 doesn't actually say anything about a form. All it requires is a plurality of fields be displayed. Now, maybe that necessarily implies a form. I don't know, but the form as such is not in the claim.
Let me ask you a sort of a doctrinal question. You kept using the phrase doctrinally as a lead-in. What do you understand to be the purpose of the entire market value rule? That is it where the predicate is met? Now, of course, here you're saying the predicate's not met. It wasn't the source of the demand, but assume a case where the predicate is met. I'm trying to understand what the function of the entire market value rule would be. And I can imagine that maybe the function is, where the predicate's met again, to start with the sales price of the product and then shift the burden to the infringer to start subtracting by that, by his having to carry a burden of proof. Well, our manufacturing costs were so-and-so, and our distribution costs were so-and-so, and all the rest, and therefore that number starts going down, down, down. Whereas in the absence of the entire market value rule, perhaps, the burden is entirely on the patentee to start with zero and go up from zero to reach some sensible number. Is that your concept of what the purpose and function of the entire market value rule is?
Not exactly. What I would say is the fundamental purpose of the entire market value rule is to implement the statute, which is to award damages to compensate for the infringement.
Sure.
Now, when you get into the question of apportionment, it may be the case that, again, assuming the threshold conditions and all that, that then apportionment becomes an issue. But I guess where I would take issue with you, Chief Judge Michel, is on whom the burden rests. The Supreme Court in the Gerritsen case back in the 1880s, which is one of the origins of the entire market value rule, placed the burden of apportionment squarely on the patentee. It is the patentee's burden to prove the damages to which he is entitled.
Well, no question of that. Everybody would agree with that. So another way to phrase my question is the entire market value rule a shortcut that allows the patentee to vault from zero to 100% of the sales price and thereby put the burden on the infringer to reduce that?
Reduce that by saying a good portion of the sales is due to unpatented aspects of the product.
Or patented by somebody else.
But see, then I think, Your Honor, then you've gotten away from the premise that got you into this question in the first place. I mean, once you say that a substantial amount of the sales are attributable to other products, other features or other patents, then you're not in the entire market value arena at all. Because I think
That's the question. That's not so clear to me that you're right about that. You may be right. I'm trying to sort this all out. It's a very confusing area of the law, it seems like to me.
Well, as somebody who has recently read a lot of the cases, I agree.
The basic premise is the patentee has to prove damages, even reasonable royalty-type damages as opposed to lost profits. We all agree with that. So then the question is, does he have to do that starting at zero, or is the entire market value rule an exception that lets him not have to build from the ground up?
No, I don't think it's an exception. I think the patentee still has the burden to build from the ground up. If the patentee, and let me take a step back, there's no question that if infringement is proven and the patent is valid, the patentee is entitled to damages. The patentee is entitled to the minimum reasonable royalty or to some other measure based on the value of what he patented. Now, if he's trying to get damages for something else, something much larger, particularly in this case, much, much larger than what he patented, it is the patentee's burden, and it's entirely appropriate that it be the patentee's burden to prove every step necessary to get that much larger award.
If that's true, and it may be absolutely true, then why is there an entire market value rule? Because it would have no purpose. The patentee would always have to start at zero and prove constituent amounts to get to a total dollar figure.
No, I don't think that's true, Your Honor, because you can imagine a case, not this one, but you can imagine a case where there are, in fact, other unpatented features or components in the product or a product or features patented by somebody else, but they are insignificant. And it is the patented feature that really is the reason people buy the thing.
So then the entire market value rule is for the, what I would say is an exceedingly rare case where the one chip in the 1,000-chip computer is the whole reason people buy that computer versus all the alternatives. Almost a freaky case. It's going to happen once a decade maybe.
Well, I don't know if it'll be a freaky case. I don't think it's going to be the norm when you have multi-featured, multi-component products. I think it probably will be fairly rare that you can point to one of those features
So then excluding that case, whether it's a tenth of a percent or 1% or whatever, we don't know. But that thin slice covered by the entire market value rule, every other case requiring build-up by the patent owner.
Every other case requires some proof of what this patented feature is worth. comparable license agreements, to the extent that the thing is in some other context sold separately, what have you. Cost savings that it makes possible. There are a variety of ways you could do it.
But basically, the patentee has to prove what value was added to the total product by the claimed invention.
Exactly. I think that's exactly right, Your Honor.
Methods may be different. Now, let me ask you this, a little bit different aspect of this entire market value rule subject. If the entire market value rule properly applies, then you are working with the entire market value figure product sale price, at least as a starting point. In the absence of applying the entire market value rule, let's assume the predicate isn't shown, isn't it appropriate to use the sales price of the overall product, only one component of which is patented, if there's no other number that's known, that's available?
No, it is
never,
not.
Never appropriate to use the total sales price.
I think once you, and by stipulation in your question, you have failed to satisfy the requirements of the entire market value rule. I think at that point, the value or the price of the total product is off the table. And there have to be other ways.
Why couldn't you use the total product price if the patentee retains the burden to establish what portion of that total price he's entitled to, because he can show that it corresponds to the value added by his invention compared to all the other features?
Well, maybe I was just having a semantic disagreement with you then. I suppose you can imagine a technique where the patentee is able to estimate or come up with some calculation of the value of his feature based on the value of the overall thing. That may well be possible.
Now, what about the admitted simple arithmetic that even if you have a very high base, if you have a very low percentage, you could get the same figure as with a smaller base and a higher percentage? Mm-hmm. And therefore, to the extent we're trying to prevent an outsized award, even if you start with the total product price of a one component infringement, as long as the multiplier, the percentage, is low enough, you would get a rational award, right?
You would get this. You could arrive at the same arithmetic result.
Right.
But I think what you're proposing, Your Honor, throws the entire market value rule out the window, because you can always say, well, you know, we can have the world be our royalty base, but if we make the rate low enough, everything will work out fine. And maybe as a policy matter, maybe that's, if you were designing a system from scratch, maybe that's what you would do. But that's not the system we have. The Supreme Court, in decisions, as I said, going back to the 19th century, has made it very clear that the entire market value rule is, in fact, a rule. And that's what we're dealing with here. And so fiddling with the numbers so that you get out, arrive at what you think is the same result, is not the appropriate way to proceed.
Mr. Trella, it seems to me we're thinking of the entire market value rule differently in this context than we have in the past, where we're talking about a larger sales price and working back. I'm thinking back to Right-Height, where I think we applied the entire market value rule, which we didn't originate there, obviously. And the point there was add-ons, add-ons to the basic infringing product. And I think, not to characterize our holdings in public, that we probably tightened it up a little bit by saying there had to be a functional relationship. That's a probably more traditional application of the entire market value rule. Is it not, than what we're talking about here? Instead of we were adding on then, or perhaps the law had added on then to formulate the entire market value rule, whereas here we're scaling down.
Well, I think it's probably true that at the time of Right-Height, that was the more common scenario in which you'd see entire market value questions. I'm not sure that's true anymore, Your Honor. I think cases like this one, a single product, no add-ons, but with a multitude of features, is the supposed accused product.
Couldn't Right Height be interpreted as being better characterized not as an entire market value rule case, but as a convoy goods case where you had two or more separate products, one of which infringes, and then the additional products don't infringe, but because they're all sold together, you allow the patentee to get the total economic value of the multi-product package.
I think that's a fair reading. Now, of course, you do have, as Judge Lurie mentioned, the functional unit notion, which...
But that would be a predicate of combining several products.
Right.
But in our case, we only have one product.
We have one product.
So it seems that the Right Height convoyed goods discussion doesn't help us in this case.
I think the convoyed goods discussion is probably not directly applicable, but to a large extent, what Right Height was doing, I think, was synthesizing the entire market value rule as it had evolved.
Well, even for a one-product case?
Even for a one-product case, yes,
Your Honor. In Right Height, the entire product was patented. There was no question about that. So it is hard to draw the analogy.
Well, I think in Right Height and
it was a question of convoyed sales.
You had an entire product, and the entire product was patented, unlike here. And then you also had the question of the things that were typically sold and used with it.
You know, this is an irrelevant observation, but it's just astounding. When we think about Right Height and what shadow it puts over this case, Right Height was a decade and a half ago or more, if I'm recalling the date correctly. And in the intervening years, we've had very few cases that really plumbed the expanse of these rules, entire market value rule, apportionment, how you do the calculation, who has what burden. It's kind of amazing that since patent cases are heavily, not exclusively about damage, but heavily about damages, also injunctions, of course, but heavily about damages, that at this late date, all these years later, the 27th or 28th year of the existence of this court, there still seems to be massive unclarity about how reasonable royalty damages are to be calculated.
Well, Your Honor, I think there is, I'm not sure that there's a tremendous lack of clarity. I do think that in cases like this one, the application of the entire market value rule is fairly clear. And certainly there are nuances, and you can imagine situations in which questions might arise, and those questions obviously have to await the proper case. This case, I would submit, is a simple case in that regard. And also, Your Honor, and not to beat a dead horse, but I do think you don't even get to this because of the lack of proof of direct infringement here. You clearly have to have direct infringement.
Is it your view that in order to have damages, that you would have to quantify how many different people used the method how many times, wherever those computer users might be all over the world?
I think you would have to, and I'll use
it. That's your view, isn't it, that you would have to quantify the actual uses in order to calibrate the damages?
I think you would have to quantify, and I don't mean to the last person necessarily, but you would have to quantify the number of product units that were used to infringe. Now, whether customer A who bought it used the patented method once or 10 times, I don't think that matters. But the fact that the product was sold and was used to infringe.
So if 110 million people bought Outlook, there are 110 people who've got that on their computer, 110 million people have that on their computer. So the patentee would have to show how many of that 110 million, once or more, used the patented feature?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
And absent that, there would just be zero damages, in your view.
That's correct, Your Honor.
But it doesn't that create an extremely difficult burden as a practical matter for the patentee, maybe an almost impossible burden?
No, I don't think it does. Again, I think it's important to recognize that you're only in this boat to the extent that the product does not have substantial non-infringing uses, which these products obviously do. So you take away that whole slew of cases as not contributing to the problem, at least not in the same way. But again, as to return to the court's references in ACCO, I think you can use survey testimony. You can get testimony from customers. And again, you don't have to march 110 million people through a courtroom. Juries make these kinds of decisions all the time. Clearly, circumstantial evidence is adequate. And if you have statistically valid surveys or sufficient testimony from large corporate users, for example, a jury could draw an inference that 80% or 50% or what have you of the units
are used. How about here? Is it your view that there was no proof of particular uses by software possessors of the patented method?
That's exactly our view, Your Honor. And there are
so zero damages in your view?
Yes, Your Honor.
Then why did your expert admit that the reasonable royalty would be $6.5 million, if I recall?
Well, Your Honor, our expert, as any damages expert does in a case, assumes infringement, assumes that the jury has found infringement, and offers his damages testimony. So the fact that he, and he assumed validity too, and we don't think the patent is valid. So I don't, I wouldn't attach any significance to the fact that we presented a damages case.
Now, so is it your view that liability and quantifying damages are in absolute lockstep, that they have to be scaled by proof somehow of actual use of the patented method?
Yes, I think Dynacor holds that. I think DSU Medical holds that. And again, lockstep may be strong, but they have to be tethered to one another. There has to be a relationship between the scope of the proven direct infringement and the scope of the claim damages.
Well, we've given you lots of extra time.
You have indeed.
Let's give equal time to the other side and hear from them, and you will restore your reserve rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Counsel, good morning. We have a very interesting case before us, and we look forward to your insights.
Good morning, Your Honor.
It would be helpful to me. I know that we've spent all of this time on damages, and we only gave Mr. Trella a few moments on validity, but could you start with an equally few moments on your position on validity?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, that's where I intended to start, so we're on the same page. May it please the Court, John Damaris for Lucent Technologies. Today, as we all stand here, computerized forms and pop-up menus and calendar tools are ubiquitous. And that's one of the things that makes this case very interesting. This is the age-old case of an obviousness analysis where we have to put ourselves back in time 25 years before Microsoft Windows, before Apple Computer was a home name, before everyone had their iPods. Now everybody's using pop-up tools. When this patent was invented almost 25 years ago, nobody was doing pop-up tools. What the patent tried to do at the time, it was addressing the problem of how do you fill out these forms without using a keyboard in some sort of efficient way that users
could... The question was that nobody, because there was the reference which was brought up, which...
That's exactly...
This, and that's the distinction that I'd be interested in.
That's exactly where I'm going, Your Honor. There's a fundamental difference between those two things, the patent and what was in the Datamation article. The patent was addressing the issue of how do you fill out on a computer screen a form, go from field to field in the form, and get the information in an efficient way with pop-up tools relevant to each field, indicating which field you're working in. And when you're done, you're going to have a nice, well-filled-out form. You're going to eliminate the mistakes. That is not what's being described in the Datamation publication. The Datamation publication was after something else. What they were doing...
Meaning what?
That I'm about
to explain.
It's
not relevant art, that it's not analogous art, that it just has no business in this case at all?
That's not where I was going. I'm going to tell you what it was after and then tell you why that means the limitations are missing. Because it brings to life the limitations that are missing, and that's where I'm going. So what they were trying to do in the system described in the Datamation article was traders are making trades in the foreign exchange, and they need to get the prices in as quickly as possible. They're doing 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 trades a day. This is all described in the publication. And so what they needed was a system they could quickly get the data in and have it get into the system and be processed. They weren't trying to make complete forms and fill out forms. So when you actually read the article to see what's disclosed, what they talk about is pushing a sell button and a tool pop up, they put in the price or what have you. That goes into the system, and then they move on to the next one. They are not filling out a form. It's much like a...
Why is it that just a one-field form?
It's not for this reason, Your Honor. If you think about what you do at... First of all, the claim requires a plurality of forms, but even more importantly, when you, a common day example today, which I think will bring it to life for you, is an ATM machine. If you go to an ATM machine today and you want to make a deposit, you push a deposit button, up pops a number pad, you put in the amount you want to deposit, and that gets submitted into the system. You are not, when you're doing that, filling out a deposit form. You're not putting in your name, your bank account number, the address, the amount of the deposit. You're not filling in the fields of a form. You are merely pushing a deposit button, entering the amount that goes into the system and it gets processed. That is analogous to what was going on in the Datamation publication. Why is this relevant? If you look at the claim limitations, what the claim limitations talk about, the first claim limitation that's missing from the prior art, displaying on said display a plurality of information fields. That's the form. You're going to have a plurality of these fields displayed on the display. In the prior art publication, there are no fields. All that gets displayed is the tool. You put in the information, and the information goes into the system. It doesn't go onto the display. There is no disclosure about it going onto the display.
We're talking about obviousness here, not anticipation.
I'm going to go one by one through the elements, and then I'll tell you why it's not obvious. So first of all, they're not, in the prior art, filling out a form. There is not a plurality of fields displayed on the display. You can read that article cover to cover. It's not in there.
The fact that the article talks about a single number going into a one field form, if I can use the terminology, it would seem it would be very easy to extrapolate that to a multi-field form and say, well, use the same technique, even though now you're going to put in eight pieces of data in eight different places instead of just one piece in one place.
When you're put This goes back to the first comment I made, Your Honor, which is put yourself back 25 years ago.
Sure.
25 years ago, I was still in college working with a terminal on a mainframe in text mode. We had no graphics on the computer. We had no pop-up tools. We had none of this stuff. So to say that it's obvious.
I'm not saying it's obvious or not. I'm saying wouldn't it be easy to extrapolate from the one fact, one field situation to the multi-field situation, you would just use the same technique in a plurality of places instead of in one place.
What they were doing in the prior art reference was not filling in a field in a form. They were typing in the cell information into the tool that popped up. It wasn't even a field on a form. All it was they pushed a cell button and up would pop the tool, and they would put the information in the tool and then it would be entered into the system. There is no field in the context that is being used in the patent. In the patent, they're talking about a display on the screen of fields that constitute a form, and that wasn't the intent of the prior art publication. More importantly, going on to the next limitation, the third limitation, it's indicating a particular one of said information fields into which the information is going to be inserted. Again, entirely lacking. Everybody admits it's lacking. Microsoft's expert admits it's lacking. And it's lacking for the reason that that publication was going after something else. In the patent, you're filling out a form on a screen that has a lot of fields, and it's important to indicate which one you're working in so you know, and then you can move to the next one and the tools will pop up. That has nothing to do with the prior art publication.
Just let me interject to be sure I remember this correctly. This is a one reference obviousness issue?
Yes, Your Honor.
That article is the only reference?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, go ahead.
Last limitation. Last one I'm talking about in this, not the last one I'm going to talk about. Inserting in said one information field that is derived as a result of said user operating said displayed tool. So you've got to, number one, you've got to have a form with multiple plurality fields. That's lacking. You've got to have an indication as to which field you're working on. That's lacking. The last limitation, inserting into that field the information that you've derived from the tool. That's lacking. All the article says is you're going to use the tool, it's going to go into the system. It doesn't talk about forms, plurality of fields, indicating or inserting. So when you think back about what was that article after, it just wanted the information as quickly as possible to get into the system so they could process their 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 trades.
How does that differ from the goal here?
The goal here, in fact, what's described in the patent is, I think, a prototypical rental car agency where you've got a detailed form about how many cars you're going to fill in. You know, you put in the person's name,
Isn't the basic goal to get it done quickly and accurately and simply?
In that sense, it's
the same as the goal for the traders.
The traders were not interested in filling out forms. They were interested in quickly digesting information. That's why they say it goes into the system as opposed to onto a display of a form. They don't want to be bothered with the filling out an accurate, complete form. It was a different approach. That's why the claim limitations are missing, or of a plurality of fields, of indicating which field you're working in, of inserting the information into the field onto the display of the screen. What you're talking about here, frankly, at the time, back in 1985 and 1986, had never been done before in this way. So when you look at what was going on, all of these limitations are missing because of where they're coming from. But that's not all that's missing. There's also the composition tool is missing. The claim, this is in the second half of the third element, a tool adapted to allow said user to compose said information. The district court interpreted that to be a graphical keyboard or a graphical number keypad. Why is that relevant at the time? What the Day patent describes is a graphical way to create these images on the screen. And when they go through the detailed description, that's describing what's called graphics mode. This is all in the trial record. And our expert testified, Dr. Tagazzini, that graphical in this context means graphics mode. It's what's described in the Day patent. And Microsoft's expert and our expert both agree the prior art publication was something that was done in text mode, not graphics mode. It's an entirely different approach to the problem, which is probably another reason why they didn't have all the fields on the screen displayed.
Mr. Damaris, so, what about the argument that there was no proof of actual infringement and the related question of the lack of evidence concerning the proper base for determining the royalty?
You ready for me to move on from validity? Yes, I'll address those two things. Now, may I make one more point about validity before I move on, just to make it clear? We've also, as we described in our brief, concurrently displaying is also missing. So I just wanted to point that out. You've got all of that form information missing, you've got the graphical tools missing, and you've got concurrently displaying missing, all relevant to what was going on. So to get to Your Honor's point now about direct infringement, I think there's a couple ways to look at it. First of all, if you look at the inducement line of cases, which I'm sure Your Honors are all very well familiar with, there are essentially two sets of cases. There are the cases where the normal use and operation of the products are not infringing, and the patent owner is trying to argue that a particular combination or a particular setup is infringing. And in those particular cases, epitomized by Dynacor and ACCO and those other cases, the patent owner has to prove that there were those specific combinations created, because in all of those cases, the normal operation was not infringing, or there were no instructions or teaching or any of that to infringe. Here, this is more along the line of cases that's headed up by most recently RICO, that talks about when you have teaching and instruction and the products are designed to infringe, then the way that you prove direct infringement is by circumstantial evidence. You prove the teachings, the marketing, the advertising. You prove that the products were designed to infringe.
Well, what
you prove
product,
large sales.
What if the product, that product failed?
How do you mean?
They incorporate this feature in the machine and no one uses it because it isn't of much use. When people use Outlook for email and may very well not use it for keeping the calendar.
I think that would depend on the proof in the case. Just to put your mind at ease here, the evidence of record is that the calendaring is used. On A7801, we introduced through our expert, Dr. Smith, testimony from Microsoft, where Microsoft was asked, does Microsoft have an understanding as to whether its customers use calendaring feature in Outlook? And the witness said, I don't know. We actually have specific usage stats about how many customers use the calendaring feature. We know many customers use them, but we don't know how many and what percentage. So there's no doubt that people are using calendar, but let's step back for a minute. What is it that has to be done in order to be an infringement? First of all, I think it's a fundamental question here, because the way the claim reads, whether they're using the calendar tool or not doesn't make infringement. What claim 19 says is you have to use a tool. That tool needs to be selected from a group that includes a composition tool, a menu of alternatives, etc. The claim requires the use of a tool, not the use of the calendar pop-up tool.
Would that include email?
That would include any... Yes, is the answer to the question. You have what the patent is getting at, as I was explaining. There is a form on the computer with fields to be filled out. The claim requires that you use tools to fill out the fields. The claim requires that those tools be selected from a group of tools, and those group of tools must include a menu of alternatives and a composition tool. They could include many other things. Which tool you choose to use is not relevant for the purposes of infringement, only that you have a system with a collection of tools that includes those two types. So for Microsoft to come up and say, we don't know how many people are using the calendar pop-up, that's not a relevant inquiry here for the direct infringement question. The direct infringement question is, are people using the tools that Microsoft put in the software, and are those tools being selected from a group that includes composition tools and menu tools? So what is the evidence?
And you're saying if someone bought the computer without looking in it, they're infringing.
You can't, the testimony from our expert in the record, you can't use Money, Microsoft Mobile, and Outlook without using the tools. It's inevitable you will use the tools. In Money, our expert specifically testified you have to use some of the tools when you're filling out the forms. Microsoft Mobile is a handheld device. You know how those handheld devices work? You don't even have a keyboard. You have to use the tools.
Outlook, that's limited to where you're filling out a form?
It's all form. These programs are all forms. There's only three programs that were accused of infringement. Money is putting information about your finances into the system. You're putting it in through forms. That's the only way you can do it. Microsoft Mobile, it's all forms. That's the way the whole system works. And on Outlook, whether you're doing email or the appointment calendar, which is what we spent a lot of time with at the trial, they're all form-based. So on the email, you're putting in the to line. You're putting in the from line. You're putting in... It's putting information into the form. So all of these programs, that you can only use them with forms.
As a user, can I put the information in using the keyboard?
In some cases, you can. But what the testimony was is that for Money, some of the information has to go in through the tools. Our expert testified to that. For Microsoft Mobile, you have to use the tools. It's a handheld. You don't have a keyboard. You could conceivably plug the handheld into a main computer that has a keyboard and do that, but that's obviously not the intended normal use. And with Microsoft Outlook, their own advertising says every item in Outlook is a form, and you have to use the tools to fill out the form. You could go out of your way to not use the tools on some occasions in Outlook, but that's contrary to the way the program was designed. It's designed to get you to use the tools. The help files tell you to use the tools, and all the marketing and advertising tell you to use the tools.
What about the quantification problem? Suppose that we actually knew how many of the Microsoft customers employed the infringing method. And I believe the figure of total sales was about 110 million. Suppose we actually knew that 1 million out of the 110 million use the tools that would be infringements.
I think
and all the others didn't.
I think there's a fundamental misunderstanding going on with the approach that Microsoft's taking to this case. And to answer that question, you've framed it perfectly, which is there is a difference in the law between lost profits and reasonable royalty. Lost profits is more interested in the question that you asked, because in a lost profits context, you've lost a sale, and you want to give the patent owner what they lost. So you've got to agonize over how many actual sales
what's the portion. This is only a reasonable royalty.
Exactly. So in the reasonable royalty context, that question in a case like this is not relevant, because what Georgia-Pacific tells us and what this court's precedent has followed going beyond Georgia-Pacific and even before is in the royalty context, we're going to have a hypothetical negotiation, and we're going to treat that as what would have happened in the real world. That's what the equation is. And this court has two lines of cases that crystallize this point. There's a line of cases that say
It doesn't help us to say real world.
I'm about to explain, Your Honor. In the Alpine case, for instance, this court said, it's hard to figure out how many times the snowmaking equipment is going to be used. So in the real-world reasonable royalty negotiation, when a licensee and licensor are sitting down, they're not going to set up a framework that's going to pay for infringements based on actual uses, because they're not going to go around and agonize over how many times each person used the snowmaking equipment. The Supreme Court came to exactly the same conclusion in the Zenith case. In the Zenith case...
Yeah, but what does that mean? Does that mean that quantification is utterly irrelevant, that we don't care whether it was once or a million times or 100 million times?
No, not at all, Your Honor. It's not irrelevant for the point of view of what is the base, how many of the actual infringements there were. It's relevant on the rate side. So what happens in the real world, and this is evidence in the record, our expert testified to this, he's been in this business 2 decades. He was the head of licensing for IBM. What he testified to is in this real world, in this market, a licensor and a licensee sit across the table from each other, and they say to each other, okay, I've got a patent, this is what it covers, you're going to sell this many products, let's talk about how we're going to structure this. We want to make it on a reportable thing so that we don't have to go around looking for how many people used it. So put it on total sales of this product. Put it on worldwide sales. Put it on whatever. And whether, then they negotiate the rate. That's
whether,
what happens.
Whether you account for proportionality in the base or in the percentage doesn't seem to matter. The question is, do you adequately account for it on one side of the equation or the other?
Right. It needs to be accounted for in the sense of what is that real-world negotiation that Georgia-Pacific describes going to yield?
Sure.
But it's not tethered to how many actual infringements.
If I'm the infringer and I'm only going to infringe once in a great while, I'm not going to pay very much for a license. But so the quantity does matter to the bargaining positions of the two sides in the hypothetical negotiation.
Exactly. Yes, it does. It matters at the time of the hypothetical negotiation. It doesn't matter today. And that's the point I'm trying to make. Microsoft's argument up here is Lucent didn't prove how many exact infringements there were. And I'm saying that's not relevant. The question is, at the time of the hypothetical negotiation, what result would the parties have achieved? And let me just read from the Supreme Court in Zenith.
We don't know, because the thing is a total fiction to begin with.
It's hypothetical, but it's supposed to reflect the real world.
But how do you know whether it's reflecting the real world?
I put in proof, and they put in proof, and the jury decides.
You have a percentage. Let's say it's 8%. Then you say, well, that 8% adequately took into account that lots of people who have the product won't use it in an infringing way, and other people who have the product will use it in an infringing way.
Right.
But if you have no idea how many people infringe or how often, how do you know the 8% is right? How do you know it shouldn't be 15% or 1%?
To answer your question, I think you have to focus on what is the royalty analysis, because it's not relevant to say today there are this many people who infringe and there are this many people not. The Georgia-Pacific and hypothetical negotiation is supposed to happen at the time. And this court's cases make this point explicit. And so in this Supreme Court case, Zenith, it says...
I don't see how the time makes any difference.
In both
today or back at the time of the hypothetical negotiation, the two bargaining parties are trying to figure out what's the economic worth of the ability to use the patent.
Here's why it makes a difference.
And therefore, quantities do matter in either time frame. Have to matter. That's what business is all about. Quantities, dollars, numbers of products.
Here's two cases perfectly on point, Your Honor. In the Interactive Pictures case and the Snellman case, both lump sum royalty cases, the royalty at the hypothetical negotiation was analyzed based on what the expected sales were going to be. In both cases, it turned out to be totally wrong. It was overinflating the amount of sales. The lump sum was paid. The case then is confronted with the issue of, at the time of the negotiation, there was a negotiation, a rate set, and a royalty paid. Today we know that that was an overestimation of how many sales there are going to actually be. Today there's only these many sales. Court says that's not how it works. That was a lump sum royalty. It was reasonable at the time. You live with the consequences.
How do we know it was reasonable at the time?
I put in expert testimony from Roger Smith, who has 2 decades in this field. He worked for IBM. He talked about how it's done in this field and what the rates are.
He may be the best expert in the world, but the law can't be that if he says it, the jury has to accept it, on post-verdict motions, the trial judge has to accept it, the Court of Appeals has to accept it, the Supreme Court has to accept it. That can't be the law. There's got to be some outliers at the margins where you just say, he said it, but it had no foundation in reality that was put in the record. Therefore, he said it, but it has to be rejected.
I couldn't agree with you more that if he just said it, I'd be here with an issue. He didn't just say it. He said it based on what happened at the trial. So he talked, his testimony went on for hours and hours. He talked about the advertisements. He talked about the marketing. He talked about how Microsoft was selling these products. He talked about what every single Microsoft marketing witness said. We put up blow-ups of the marketing witness's testimony, why these products are important, why the tools are important, why the forms are important.
And he went through the whole history of the fact. Mr. Trella argues that if you look at the amount the jury actually awarded and you look at the sales and the sale average sales price, that you can calculate that the award represented approximately 8% of the average total sales price. So just accept hypothetically that that's true. In the context of this case or this kind of case, how would a reviewing court know whether the 8% is a realistic figure that is proportional and reflects what business people would actually think if they were doing a negotiation?
I think the job of this court is to look at whether in the trial record there was substantial evidence to support that 8%. And in this record, we put in many, many agreements. We put in...
But to the extent that Roger Smith was using 8%, what foundation did he offer explicitly as the basis of that proportionality, that 8%?
Well, specifically with respect to the 8%, there was a lot of data, but there were, specifically with respect to that number, a few IBM agreements that licensed software for 8% to Dell. And so in the computer industry, you know, here's two parties relevant to this case. Dell was a defendant at the time. And there's specific license agreements right on point that at that time, 8% was the right number. But that's just one data point. There was a lot of other data points.
8% has got to be in a context. If you're one company and Judge Lurie is another company and you both have thousands of patents and you're cross-licensing thousands of patents, and in that context 8% is what you both agree on immediately without even a long negotiation, fine. But then in a case involving one patent and no cross-licensing and different sorts of players in the market, it seems to me 8% might be totally nuts.
I would agree with you. 8% depends on the context. But what happened here
but the context was established at the trial. Supposedly comparable license agreements here don't look terribly comparable, at least not to my eye.
First of all, our job at the reviewing court is to look at what happened below. What happened below was our expert went through the licenses, explained what was different and what was the same, explained to the jury how the jury might adjust, went through the marketing, the advertising, went through all the other licenses, and did a comprehensive damages presentation. Microsoft then put their expert on and did exactly the same thing from their approach. And it's a quintessential fact issue for the jury about which way are they going to go and who are they going to believe and what are they going to discount and how are they going to come out with what they think is fair. This court's job is not to decide what this court thinks is fair on the royalty.
Does that mean that if the figure chosen by the jury falls in the intervening space between one expert and the other, it has to be affirmed every time?
No. It has to be affirmed every time there's substantial evidence in the record.
Well, how do we know that the evidence is substantial?
Is there evidence that a reasonable jury could have concluded 8%? So if you look at what...
Just rewording the legal standard. I know what the legal standards are. But as a factual matter, how do you know when that standard is met and when it's not met?
You have to look at what was presented at the trial record and see if it... Let me try this on for you, which I think may give you comfort. In this particular case, there are many ways to get to that number. Microsoft proposed one in its brief. There are at least... two other real easy ways for them to get to that, and this is one of the points I want to make now, which is I take Your Honor's comments that it's been a long time since the court wrote a entire market value opinion that sort of elaborates on the nuances of entire market value.
Well, the ones we did write seem to be utterly unclear and unhelpful. I don't get any assistance out of the cases we've written before.
But it's not relevant to these facts.
Yeah. I sort of like the opinion.
I stand corrected.
This is not the case for the court to write an entire market value opinion. Why is that? It's not an entire market value case. If you look at what actually happened in the case, Microsoft speculates that the jury did a rate times a base and used the entire market value rule. If you look at what they actually wrote on the verdict form, they awarded a lump sum. And they said, what is the royalty rate you apply? And they said, we're not applying one, not applicable. What happened at the trial was we presented the 8% on the software
as a
base.
So if I'm a juror and I don't want to get reversed, I'm the foreman of the jury. I just always put it in the column under lump sum. And under base, I put blank line. Under rate, strikeout, and I've got an immune verdict.
It's not our job to speculate on what the jury did. We're stuck with what they did. And so what happened was we presented 8% on the base. Microsoft's presentation at the trial level was you should award a lump sum, and they offered 6.5%. And they gave all the reasons why.
6.5 million.
Thank you, Your Honor. And they gave all the reasons to the jury why a lump sum was the appropriate royalty. Then the jury was specifically asked, did you go with a rate? And on the verdict form, they said no, and they awarded a lump sum.
We know what the form says. There's no dispute about
that. So our job here, then, is confronted with that set of facts. It's not relevant what the jury actually did in the room. What's relevant is that we got a lump sum verdict. Is that supportable and sustainable on the law? Is there evidence in the record, substantial evidence, that that is a reasonable verdict? Why is it reasonable?
Would you accept this as the shortcut review standard? If we read every word of Roger Smith's testimony and it's plausible, the case is over.
I think so.
And if it's implausible, the case is over the other way.
Or remanded, right? So if we look at the trial record to determine whether the lump sum, whether there's substantial evidence in the... First of all, if you agree with me that the jury awarded a lump sum like they said they did, we never get to the entire market value rule. You don't need to write an opinion on it. This isn't the case for it. And then once we get to that point, all we have to decide is there evidence, substantial evidence in the record that can support a lump sum of that magnitude? There's plenty of evidence in the record that can support a lump sum of that magnitude. We put many licenses in the record, IBM, Dell, Microsoft, Imprise, all in the hundreds of millions of dollars lump sums. The jury could have extrapolated from those licenses. Equally, we put licenses in the record that were a dollar value per unit. And here, we had 110 million units. There's a dollar value license Lucent Voxcom for $2 a unit. There's a dollar value license Microsoft MPEG-LA for $4 a unit. If you do either one of those, you get to $356 million quite readily. So when you look at the evidence that's in the record, forget about Roger Smith, look at the licenses that, from the licenses alone, the jury could have extrapolated a lump sum entirely supportive of their verdict. We never get to the entire market value rule. We don't need to spend a lot of time on it. So that, in my view, is the proper analysis here. The jury told us it was a lump sum. They said they didn't apply a rate times a base. And is that lump sum supportable? Yes, it is. We save for another day the entire market value rule. Let me just mention quickly the cross appeal. There were apparatus claims in this case as well. The court dismissed them on summary judgment for the sole reason that the expert did not rely on the source code in his expert opinion on the apparatus claims. And Microsoft says that he did just a functional analysis, and the court agreed and dismissed on summary judgment. When you look at what the expert actually did and what the expert actually testified to, it was clearly a structural analysis. He tested the equipment. He has history in this particular field. He talked about the microprocessor and how it was programmed, and he ran through all the programs himself live doing tests and testified that the apparatus claim elements were met. The functions in this case were very straightforward.
Is this cross appeal moot if you win on the main appeal?
Yes. So the functions here are very, very simplistic. it's a microprocessor program with an algorithm that displays a form, a microprocessor program with an algorithm that indicates, a microprocessor with an algorithm that inserts information, etc. When you look at the testimony from the expert, and he testified in detail about how from his testing you could observe these algorithms, and that was sufficient to meet the apparatus claims, so there were fact issues that precluded summary judgment. Our expert's detailed opinion on the operation of the products, the simple nature of the corresponding structure, and the feasibility of determining identity or equivalence of the structure, all of these precluded summary judgment. So if you were to reverse on any part of the case, we would ask you to also reverse on the apparatus.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Trella, 3 minutes.
I need to return to a subject that I started to talk about, and that is Lucent's expansion of the infringement theory on appeal. It is simply not true that you don't have to use the composition tool to infringe using Outlook, and here's why. You have to use a tool selected from a group that includes at least a tool that includes a menu of alternatives and at least a tool adapted to allow said user to compose said information. The predicate in the claim for said information is information of the kind identified for said one field. So the group of tools from which the tool you're using is selected has to include this kind of composition tool. That is a composition tool that can supply information for that field. Lucent's expert testified that Outlook has only one composition tool. That's the date picker. So the only field that can be filled using that composition tool is the date field. That's why their entire case at trial focused on that. Moreover, the date picker tool is the only tool that can be used for that date field. There are two ways to fill it in, by typing on the physical keyboard, which everybody agrees does not infringe, or by using that date picker. So if you don't use that date picker, you do not infringe. And moreover, if the date picker is not included in Outlook, again, because it's the only composition tool, Outlook cannot possibly infringe. So everything turns on the date picker, and this notion that any use of pop-up tools anywhere on any form infringes is just nonsense. It is not supported by the claim language, and it's why their expert testified repeatedly, and we quote this at, I think, pages 22 to 24 of our brief, testified repeatedly that you have to use the date picker. Another point I'd like to make along the same lines is Lucent's counsel pointed to testimony referring, general testimony saying, we're sure that some customers use the calendaring feature. That's not the date picker. The calendaring feature is the appointment feature in Outlook. That's what's being referred to. We don't dispute that people use the appointment feature. Of course they do. The question is, do they use the date picker? And was there any evidence of the use of the date picker when using that feature? There was not. No evidence of any infringing uses, and certainly no evidence of the extent of infringing uses. Just turning briefly to the validity questions, it is not true that only one that there was only one item being filled or being addressed in the datamation system. The article says the right half of the screen lists key information about the current transaction: buyer bank, seller bank, currency, exchange rate, etc. When the trader touches the screen in one of these areas, a list of potentially valid entries or a pop-up tool comes in to supply the information needed on the right. That is the same thing described in the Day patent. Finally, on the cross-appeal, very briefly, Lucent's expert did not identify the structure in Microsoft's products. Lucent's expert, in fact, explained how he reached his infringement conclusion. He said, you're generating an equivalent algorithm because otherwise you would not get equivalent behavior. That's at 80604 of the appendix. That's a purely functional analysis. And the notion that the district court relied on Lucent's failure to analyze source code is wrong. The district judge mentioned early in his opinion exactly once the source code issue. He mentioned it because we had argued, hey, the guy didn't even look at the source code, and everybody knows you can identify the algorithm that way. Now, there may be other ways to do it, but we were just pointing out that the most obvious way he deliberately chose not to follow. He did no structural analysis whatsoever, and this court's cases are clear that that's required. So we request that the decision be reversed and that the decision on the cross appeal be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Damaris. 1 minute. Rebuttal, cross appeal only.
Yes, Your Honor. If we have to look at what is the corresponding structure in this case to determine whether it's necessary to look at the source code or not, and whether what the expert did is sufficient. The claim structure is simply a microprocessor programmed with several algorithms. If you look at what the algorithms are, it's an algorithm that displays a form. It's an algorithm that indicates the currently active information field and displays a tool. It's an algorithm that inserts information derived from the tool into the information field. It's an algorithm that indicates the currently active field and displays the tool. These are all things that can be observed from using the system. If you sit down, load the software, use the computer, you can tell if the microprocessor is programmed with an algorithm that displays a form, because you are going to see the form on the screen and you can do things to manipulate it. The next function is an algorithm that indicates the currently active field and displays a tool. If you use the system and test it, you can see if it's doing that, and you can conclude quite reasonably that the microprocessor is a program with an algorithm that can do that. The same for the other two algorithms. I don't need to belabor the point. And the expert testified, Mr. Tognazzini testified, each of these algorithms can be observed by testing the operation of the system, which he did, and he went through each of the algorithms and the tests that he did. So there is a factual dispute about how the products operate, the simple nature of the algorithms, that you can test it and you can see, and that the corresponding structure is identical or equivalent. So there's no way that this should have been decided on summary judgment, and the issue of infringement should be reversed.
All right. Thank you very much. Very thoroughly argued by very able, well-prepared counsel. If all of the counsel who appear in front of us were as articulate and well-informed as the two of you, our job in all those other cases would be much easier. So thank you for your able assistance. The case is submitted.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All rise.